In my early 20s, I read the Quran for the first time. When I read the Quran for myself, I was trying to get a first-hand sense of what was actually in the Quran because I didn't trust the media narratives about what was in it. I find that looking at the primary sources and researching some historical and literary context is generally much more useful and accurate than the overly simplistic and often heavily politicized media coverage of any given religious tradition, including Islam. One of the things I found interesting when I first read the Quran was that there is a surah named after Mary, the mother of Jesus. The surah on Maryam, which is how her name is rendered in Arabic, has a set of rhyming schemes and other literary aspects that I do find interesting, but at the moment, I'm interested in talking about the contents of its message to the readers of the Quran. But before we get to that surah, I want to start with a surah that appears earlier in the Quran. One thing I should mention before I get too far into this is that I am not an expert in Quranic studies specifically, or in Islamic studies more generally. I try to learn from both the Quran itself and various Islamic perspectives on the Quran and the Hadith, understanding that I am learning rather than being an authoritative source of information about Islam. If you want to know more about the Quranic passages, Gnostic texts, and biblical references mentioned in this podcast, please see the link to my blog, where you can find links that will take you to additional information on those Quranic passages, Gnostic texts, and biblical references mentioned as I read and comment on the portions of the Quran which reference Mary. And if you want to know which interpretation and translation of the Quran I used, that's available on the sources page of my blog. The surah I want to begin with today is known in English as the House of Imran, and has an important narrative about Mary. The House of Imran describes the conception and birth of Mary. So why is the surah named after Imran, you might wonder? Well, the name for Mary's father in the ancient Christian tradition is Joachim, but it is rendered in Arabic as Imran. So, Mary's story begins in her father's household before she was born, the House of Imran. I'll now read the beginning of that story from the House of Imran. God chose Adam and Noah and the house of Abraham and the house of Imran above all beings, the seed of one another. God hears and knows. When the wife of Imran said, Lord, I have vowed to thee in dedication what is within my womb. Receive thou this from me, thou hearest and knowest. And when she gave birth to her, she said, Lord, I have given birth to her, a female. And God knew very well what she had given birth to. The male is not as the female. And I have named her Mary, and commend her to thee with her seed, to protect them from the accursed Satan. Her Lord received the child with gracious favor, and by his goodness she grew up comely, Zechariah taking charge of her. Whenever Zechariah went in to her in the sanctuary, he found her provisioned. Mary, he said, how comes this to thee? From God, she said. Truly God provisions whomsoever he will, without reckoning. You may have noticed that some of the important early figures of Judaism, such as Adam and Noah and Abraham, are mentioned first as the long-ago progenitors of Mary's family. It's important to note that a person's family history was culturally very important at the time and in many previous time periods, so it's not at all surprising that a person's genealogy was viewed as a necessary precursor to knowing who that person was and what significance their life might have. Also, because Muhammad's mission was to restore the true faith in the one God, it makes sense that he would go back to monotheism's roots and try to show how those roots have continuity with the new religion he was spreading in the 600s. This also helps to ease the conversion to Islam, because many people are attached to their religious heritage and don't want to lose that more so than they're attached to the philosophical claims of their religion. If a person can keep their religious heritage intact after converting, because the new religion recognizes the legitimacy and importance of their religious inheritance, then they're less likely to have strong objections to converting. Another interesting thing to note is that although the Prophet Muhammad would have had access to the New Testament accounts of Mary's life, the material in this passage is not drawn from the New Testament accounts in the way that some other passages are. Because there are no accounts of Mary's conception in the New Testament, we can pretty safely conclude that the source for the Quranic account of her conception is the early Christian oral tradition about Mary's parentage and the circumstances of her birth, which was well established and well known in the liturgical life of the early Christian church at that point, specifically in the form of the Feast of the Nativity of the Theotokos and the Feast of her Presentation at the Temple. We know that this passage isn't based on the New Testament because the New Testament doesn't describe Zechariah as Mary's guardian. There are references to Zechariah in the New Testament, however, and he and his wife are written of in both the Quran and the Bible. The next part of the passage from the House of Imran details Zechariah's prayer for a son and God answering that prayer in the form of the birth of John the Baptist. Because it is essentially the same as another passage in the Maryam Surah that I will be reading to you later, I'm skipping it here and moving on to the next passage about Mary. So now I'll read more about Mary from the Surah, the House of Imran. And when the angels said, Mary, God has chosen thee and purified thee. He has chosen thee above all women. Mary, be obedient to thy Lord, prostrating and bowing before him. That is of the tidings of the unseen that we reveal to thee, for thou wast not with them when they were casting quills, which of them should have charge of Mary. Thou wast not with them when they were disputing. When the angels said, Mary, God gives thee good tidings of a word from him, whose name is Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, high honored shall he be in this world and the next, near stationed to God. He shall speak to men in the cradle and of age, and righteous shall he be. Lord, said Mary, how shall I have a son, seeing no mortal has touched me? Even so, God said, God creates what he will. When he decrees a thing, he does but say to it, Be, and it is. This narrative from the House of Imran is somewhat different from the narrative of the Annunciation in the New Testament. One difference is that it specifically claims that the angels declared to Mary that her son would speak to men as an infant, which is not mentioned in the New Testament, but may have come from Gnostic infancy narratives about Jesus. Another is that the means of deciding who would be Mary's guardian was apparently a randomized one, equivalent to drawing straws or flipping coins, perhaps indicating, as it did in the story of Jonah, that it was God who had made the decision that Zechariah and his wife would care for Mary. But what is most striking to me is how much honor is given to Mary, that God has chosen her above all women. And also that, in Islam, Mary has many titles given to her, just as she does in the ancient Christian traditions that were present on the Arabian Peninsula when Islam was founded. She is called Queen of the Saints, for example, a high honor indeed. Her unique place of honor in Islam may be the reason for having a surah named after her, or it may be the other way around, that the Quranic narratives are the reason for her high place of honor in Islam. Either way, the degree of honor given to Mary in the Quran seems to indicate that Christianity was a strong influence on early Islamic tradition. But Islamic tradition wasn't just being influenced by Christianity, it was also reacting against Christianity in some ways, and we'll see some examples of that in the surah entitled Maryam. Now I'll begin reading a passage from that surah named after Mary, which begins with the Bismillah, a traditional Islamic invocation. In the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. The mention of thy Lord's mercy unto his servant Zechariah, when he called upon his Lord secretly, saying, O my Lord, behold, the bones within me are feeble, and my head is all aflame with hoariness, and in calling on thee, my Lord, I have never been hitherto unprosperous. And now I fear for my kinsfolk after I am gone, and my wife is barren. So give me from thee a kinsman who shall be my inheritor, and the inheritor of the house of Jacob, and make him my Lord, well-pleasing. O Zechariah, we give thee good tidings of a boy, whose name is John. No namesake have we given him aforetime. The Quranic narrative of Zechariah's plea to God has some basic elements in common with the New Testament account. He makes reference to his old age, and he was told of his son's name. The narrative differs, however, in describing Zechariah's request for a son to make sure his property was passed down and his family cared for. That wasn't a part of the narrative in chapter 1 of the Gospel of Luke. And the Quranic narrative is missing the parts of Luke's Gospel in which the angel is telling Zechariah about John not drinking alcohol and going forth in the spirit and power of Elijah. While it's clear that Islam was influenced by Christianity, it isn't merely derivative. Some people might think that a religion being influenced by another religion, such as ancient Egyptian religion influencing Judaism, for example, negates the truth claims that religion might make. Or they might view it as suspect because of it not being completely uninfluenced by anything else. But this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I would seriously doubt that their favorite philosopher's beliefs were not at some point heavily influenced by various other philosophers, and I would wager that 100% of people who believe that they have the truth are knowingly or unknowingly influenced by other people who have quite different and even quite disagreeable beliefs, and they don't seem to think that this renders them unable to find the truth. So why assume that others who are similarly influenced can't find the truth? So the fact that Islam was heavily influenced by and also rejected important parts of Christianity is not a good argument against Islam being true. The fact that Buddhism was both influenced by and also rejected important parts of the existing Indian religions based on the Vedas does not give us any reason to think that Buddhism is not true, we would have to find some other rational way of deciding whether or not it was true. This is an important thing to keep in mind as I read the next passage from the Maryam Surah. He said, O my Lord, how shall I have a son, seeing my wife is barren and I have attained to the declining of old age? Said he, So it shall be. Thy Lord says, Easy is that for me, seeing that I created thee aforetime, when thou wast nothing. He said, Lord, appoint to me some sign. Said he, Thy sign is that thou shalt not speak to men, though being without fault, 3 nights. So he came forth unto his people from the sanctuary, then he made the signal to them, Give you glory at dawn and evening. O John, take the book forcefully. And we gave him judgment, yet a little child, and a tenderness from us, and purity, and he was God-fearing, and cherishing his parents, not arrogant, rebellious. Peace be upon him, the day he was born, and the day he dies, and the day he is raised up, alive. Zechariah's question about how this is possible, given his age and his wife's age, is also featured in the Gospel of Luke, but the narrative about his being unable to speak after asking for a sign is a little different. In the Gospel of Luke, Zechariah is made mute because he doubted the angel's announcement and is unable to speak until his son John is born. But in the Maryam Surah, he is given a much lighter sentence of 3 nights that functions as a sign of God's power, rather than both a sign and a penance as it does in Luke's Gospel. And after the part about Zechariah leaving the sanctuary of the temple to greet the people, the similarities end very quickly. In the Gospel of Luke, there is no exhortation to John about taking the book, and no prophecy about peace being upon him at birth, death, and resurrection. Now that we've learned about the Quranic depiction of John the Baptist and the strange circumstances of his conception and birth, we get to take a look at Mary's story and see that her situation has some interesting parallels to the situation of Zechariah and Elizabeth. We also see that there are some important differences, which you may notice as I read the next portion of the Maryam Surah. And mention in the book Mary when she withdrew from her people to an eastern place, and she took a veil apart from them. Then we sent unto her our spirit, that presented himself to her, a man without fault. She said, I take refuge in the All-Merciful from thee, if thou fearest God. He said, I am but a messenger come from thy Lord, to give thee a boy most pure. She said, How shall I have a son whom no mortal has touched, neither have I been unchaste? He said, Even so, thy Lord has said, Easy is that for me, and that we may appoint him a sign unto men, and a mercy from us. It is a thing decreed. Now, the beginning of this part of the passage seems to allude to Mary being a consecrated virgin, given the references to withdrawing to an eastern place and taking the veil. And this would make sense if the Prophet Muhammad was familiar with certain Christian oral traditions about Mary, though that particular oral tradition isn't present in the Gospel of Luke. Once again, the basic elements of God sending Mary a messenger to tell her she would bear a child, and her confusion about how that could happen, are common to both the Quranic and New Testament accounts. But at the end, there is an absence of Mary's agreement to the Lord's plan when she says, let it be done to me according to your word. In the Gospel of Luke, that's how Mary consents to conceive a child by the power of the Holy Spirit. But in the Quranic narrative, she doesn't consent and takes a very different attitude toward the whole thing. I'll now read the next part of the surah so that we can find out what that attitude might be. So she conceived him and withdrew with him to a distant place, and the birth pangs surprised her by the trunk of a palm tree. She said, "Would I had died ere this, and become a thing forgotten." But the one that was below her called to her, "Nay, do not sorrow. See, thy Lord has set below thee a rivulet. Shake also to thee the palm trunk, and there shall come tumbling upon thee dates, fresh and ripe. Eat therefore and drink, and be comforted. And if thou shouldst see any mortal, say, I have vowed to the All-Merciful a fast, and today I will not speak to any man." Then she brought the child to her folk, carrying him, and they said, "Mary, thou hast surely committed a monstrous thing. Sister of Aaron, thy father was not a wicked man, nor was thy mother a woman unchaste." Mary pointed to the child then. But they said, "How shall we speak to one who is still in the cradle, a little child?" The deep sense of despair experienced by Mary in the midst of the pain of childbirth while alone under a palm tree seems pretty realistic. But immediately afterwards, God provides her with an unaccounted-for source of soothing water and fresh fruit from the tree, which, as a side note, reminds me a bit of the Buddha's infancy narrative, and that's something I recommend reading on my blog if you get the chance, because it's quite interesting. Another interesting point here is that the Quranic narrative has Mary vowing to speak to no man, which is very different from the New Testament depictions of the Nativity of Jesus. Those depictions include Joseph, her betrothed, who is notably and completely absent from the Quranic narrative, which seems strange given how many Islamic cultures see it as very important that women have a male guardian. Another thing that seems very realistic is the Quranic narrative's description of her family's horrified and disappointed reaction to her having a child out of wedlock, which is then followed by something miraculous in the form of Jesus speaking to them as an infant, just as Mary's realistic childbirth pains were followed by something miraculous in the form of a child being born of a virgin. So, what does Jesus the infant say to her family in the Maryam Surah? He said, "Lo, I am God's servant. God has given me the book and made me a prophet. Blessed he has made me wherever I may be. And he has enjoined me to pray and to give alms so long as I live, and likewise to cherish my mother. He has not made me arrogant, unprosperous. Peace be upon me the day I was born, and the day I die, and the day I am raised up alive." That is Jesus, son of Mary, in word of truth, concerning which they are doubting. It is not for God to take a son unto him. Glory be to him. When he decrees a thing, he but says to it, "Be." And it is. "Surely God is my Lord and your Lord, so serve you him. This is a straight path." This Quranic narrative of Jesus speaking like an adult who knows the future while still an infant is a fascinating appropriation of and rejection of Christian tradition. It explicitly endorses the view that Jesus is a prophet, which is what Muslims believe, and denies that Jesus could be the Son of God, which is what Christians believe. and it doesn't resemble traditional Christian formulations at all. This is clearly an early Islamic tradition in the way it's written, and also in the substance of its message. Throughout the Quranic narratives on Mary, we see an interesting blend of ancient Christian tradition and early Islamic tradition that sought to return the people of the book, meaning Christians and Jews, to the straight path that the Prophet Muhammad understood them to be deviating from. The Prophet Muhammad was a reformer of religion. He believed that Christianity and Judaism had become corrupted somewhere along the way, and that he needed to restore people to the true religion of the one God. And it makes perfect sense for him to use the parts of Judaism and Christianity he saw as still being pure and true to try to draw Jews and Christians to the one true religion that he was seeking to spread across the Arabian Peninsula and everywhere else in the known world. While many of us who are not Muslims might see this as merely a useful strategic decision on the part of the Prophet Muhammad, from an Islamic perspective, the Quran was authored by God, not just inspired by God like the New Testament. And so for Muslims, it's the case that Allah the Wise, Al-Hakim in Arabic, would have provided a simple way back to the true religion to help the people of the book convert to Islam and find the right way to worship him again. Well, we've now come to the end of the podcast, and I hope you found it helpful in understanding Islam, the Quran, and the influence that existing religions have had on them a little better than you did before. I certainly learned some things in doing the research for this. On the next podcast related to the Quran, I will examine many more things the Quran says about Jesus, so please subscribe to the podcast and then you can listen to it as soon as it's published, rather than having to wait until I get it posted. So thanks for listening, and have a great evening.